Is everything we knew about the brain 20 years ago wrong? In 20 years, what we know today about the brain, will it be wrong? That's the topic today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
We're talking with Dr. Yuri Daniloff. He is the former head of the Tactile Communication and Neuromodulation Lab in the Kinesiology Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We have had a couple of podcasts already, but I had a bunch of dangling questions that I think are just fascinating that I would like to ask you about. One is about my wife. She can see colors better than I can. She will look at something and she will say, that's eggshell blue or something like that. And I will say, no, that's just blue. In talking with you, Yuri, you actually mentioned that there's a physiological reason that women have greater color perception than men in general. What's going on?
Well, that's from my past life when I was a visual neuroscientist. In Cambridge, I think still functioning emeritus professor, Dr. Mullen, who discovered that female have a three different type of red color receptors. It means that physically females have a different perceptions on the color.
And that's the reason that they can see more shades and more
It's not hues. A question of more. They have a different quality. Okay, they're perceiving the colors in a different way.
But I would say it would be a higher resolution of colors.
If there is such things as a resolution of the colors.
Okay. Another question. I learned about glia. I'm supposed to be somebody that knows what's happening in artificial neural networks and artificial intelligence, but I had never heard about glia. That came up in a conversation we had earlier today. What is glia? You say it's half of the brain. So it's something that hasn't been discovered for a long time, but it's been there. What's going on with glia?
Well,
G-L-E-A, by the way.
Yes. So if you look on a textbook, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, even in the modern textbooks, you can see nice picture of the neurons that hanging in the air. But inside of the brain, there is no such thing as empty space. Space between neurons in your every branch filled with the multiple types of different cells that have a name glia. There is astrocytes, for example, that's in the cortex. Microcytes that controlling the environment between neurons. Oligodendrocytes that create myelin sheath that isolate the fibers in the brain and the central nervous system. Multiple kind of glia. And for many, many years, people think that it's like a dough in a chocolate chip cookies.
They used to think cells were like that too, I believe, back in the mid-19th century. They thought cells were just little membranes full of gob.
Yeah. And right now, the more people study the glia, it's actually intensive interest start maybe 15 years ago, 10 years ago. When people start to discover that glia, first of all, it's a 50% by weight and 60% by numbers in the brain versus neurons. And people thought it's just a fat tissue that designed to nourish neurons and service, provide the components and oxygen and minerals and removing the rest of it. So right now, the people understand that, first of all, they organize the networks. Even more, the networks are working much faster than the neurons because they have electrical context, electrical synapses, instead of chemical like neurons. And
So glia works faster than neurons. In the sense of chemical, it's a lot faster than electrical.
No, or
the other way around.
Faster,
yeah, the electrical
right.
is much
so
more faster.
They conduct the signal faster,
mm-hmm.
okay, to be precise. When you say they works, we don't know what they do.
We don't know what the glia does?
Well, it's not what we don't know. Every year we're discovering new functions that glia does.
What are some of those functions?
Okay, one of the hypotheses why the, you know, that during the Parkinson's disorders, the development of Parkinson's disorders, people use a different, well, Parkinson's disease, it's a deficiency of dopamine. And the, of course, to help people with Parkinson, people start to use dopaminomimetics, so medicine that emulate the efficiency of dopamine or direct dopamine injections or the delivery to the body and to the brain. And what they discover, it's like levodopa, one of the typical drug for the Parkinson. But unfortunately, people know that you have to increase, continuously increase the dosage.
Of the dopamine?
Well, this kind of levodopa, for example, right? And at some point, the drug stops working. And then only one possible way to do deep brain stimulation, so implant the electrodes. And one of the hypotheses why you continuously have to increase the drug, it's a glia, because right now I told you about all our knowledge have to be modified. So for many years, people think that synapses have only two parts, presynaptic and postsynaptic.
Yes.
Right now, we're talking about three-part synapses because there is a third partner in this process. It's a glia. Or just think reasonably. So every spike deliver neuromodulator in a gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to provide efficiency for the next impulses, somebody have to clean the gap. Otherwise, it will be accumulated in a gap and efficiency will be changed. To be reliable conduction, somebody have to clean the gap for the next impulses. And these cleaners are glia. They're sucking out dopamine in a dopamine synapses. They're sucking out dopamine and reintroduce it to the neuron, right? That's a goal. But if you increase the dopamine in the environment, giving drug, you stimulate the glia to make more efficient. More dopamine in the environment, the glia start to grow and work more efficiently. You do more drug and more efficiently until they start to suck out dopamine before it's even start to work and the drug become non-effective.
Now, dopamine, that's, I believe I heard that dopamine is something that you get hit with when you go on drugs such as cocaine and such. I even learned that Facebook was doing a dopamine hit study because they wanted to see the dopamine release when somebody got excited by getting liked, for example, on one of their posts. Is that the same dopamine?
Yes, it's the same dopamine. But I better we don't start this discussion because it's by itself, it's abyss.
Oh, it is. Okay. The title of this podcast was, or at least the preamble said that everything that we knew about the brain, say 20 years ago, is incorrect today in some sense. This is a statement I got from you. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, preparing the course of lectures about the brain physiology, how today we can look on the brain function, brain anatomy, brain physiology. I realized that everything I learned when I was a student in the 70s is not true. So it's not the structure of the brain. Well, first of all, everybody talking about neuroplasticity, right?
Yes.
So in the beginning of 70s, everybody believed the brain is fixed in structure. Then it was a period when people decided brain working as a stochastic. Everything is a probability, okay? Then it's become, the plasticity become more popular. And right now people saying, well, anatomy of the brain is flexible and plastic and physiology of the brain is flexible and plastic. Yes, indeed. Right now the experiments show that mental exercise equally effective as a physical exercise. If you do it regularly in a challenging manner, you can change the thickness of the cortex, extent of the brain maps, and so on and so on. So even anatomy and physiology become flexible, right? So that's one of the major changes. Second, the structure of the brain, instead of block scheme with block A connected with block B, with positive connection, negative feedback connection from block B to block A, it's not as simple as we thought. So right now, the brain itself is three-dimensional, if not more, multi-nodes structure that dynamic. the efficiency between, or weighting coefficients, if we're talking about neural network model, weighting coefficients between elements are changeable and flexible and depend from any condition around. Even single synaptical connection, it's not one or zero when we thought in the 70s. Right now, it's everything from minus one to plus one, depending from what biochemistry in the presynaptical environment, in the intersynaptical gap and postsynaptical environment, depending from biochemical components, the signal might be even inverted as a result on the postsynaptic membrane. Another interesting thing that neuron can change neuromediator that they deliver.
What's a neuromediator?
So it's an active chemical compound that neuron deliver in synaptical gap.
Mm-hmm.
Dopamine, it's neuromediator. Serotonin, it's a neuromediator.
I see.
GABA, it's a neuromediator. Acetylcholine, it's a neuromediator. So it's a chemical that become substance for transferring the signal between neurons.
Let me ask you this. You know, we're
And by the way, so you ask me about the glia. So when in about tongue stimulation, so physically we deliver on the surface of the tongue in a 20 minutes interval, 27 millions of electrical impulses, super short length. We don't know, and nobody knows, what's the transfer rate between tongue and brainstem. It's every electrical impulses create a spike, burst of the impulse create spike, or single impulse create many spikes, we don't know. But when you deliver the millions of impulses to the brainstem, so it's mean the neurons have to deliver million times the neuromediator in the environment. So it's mean that we simultaneously activating the neuronal network through electrical spikes and glial networks through the massive biochemical impact on the brainstem.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a double activation of the brain, neuronal part and glial part.
Wow.
So that's probably explain why we have so many strong effects.
You know, this is interesting because I think many people will say this is science today and you have to believe in science as something which is written in stone. But we've just talked about how in 20 years, what was known about the brain was largely incorrect. Do you think, for example, in 2050, we'll look back at 2020 and say something similar about the brain?
Well, I wouldn't say dramatically that what we learned in the 70s was wrong. It was right on this level of understanding of the brain. And, for example, I studied all my life so-called receptive fields.
Yes.
It's a concept that appeared in 48 in a vision. Exist for about half a century, and it was a create environment and language which people used to communicate and discuss the development. For 50 years was a very useful term. Right now, I can convince everybody that it's a fiction. There is no such things as a receptive field. It's just the temporal phenomena that you can see in a specific experimental condition.
Wow.
But it's actually not exist in the
so
brain.
So this is something you studied for 40 years that you found out didn't exist.
Well, it's a result of my study.
It's a result of your studies. You looked at it closer and closer and it went away.
Well, wow. Indeed. That's our understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I start studying that, I was convinced that the receptive field is a fact and not phenomena. But right now I understand it's a phenomena.
That's really fascinating.
Okay, so that's again, it's another side of plasticity. It's another side of dynamic. So on each level, biochemical level, synaptical level, single cell level, small circuitry and clusters. We talked today about microcircuitry in the brain and macrocircuitry in the brain. We didn't discover it yet. So it's a blind spot in our understanding in the brain physiology. Maybe next 50 years we will focus on this. We'll find out how working clusters of the cells, how they integrate in a functional unit.
Now, of course, my field is artificial intelligence, artificial neural networks. And Dr. Daniloff just rolled his eyes. But and I probably agree with you, but how close is artificial intelligence to simulating the incredible things that happen in the brain?
Maybe in the 50 years I can answer this question, how close you are.
Okay.
But from my perspective, artificial intelligence is fantastic direction with great future, but they have nothing to do with natural brain. It's artificial intelligence, in my eyes, it's a very nice attempt to emulate or imitate known functions of brain, human brain, because to repeat the brain, it's impossible. Or at least in the near future, it's not even close.
Do you think the brain is just a very, very complex computer that could actually be simulated, assuming we had a big enough computer that we can do everything?
It's not a computer. Brain is not doing any programming.
But is it following an algorithm?
No.
It isn't?
No.
That is fascinating.
It's a separate discussion, extremely painful for many. But it's something that's happening right now. Because remember, I told today that how our technological development morphing our understanding of the brain works. And the attempt to make a parallel between brain and computer, it's a result of our evolution, if you wish. Because in my eyes, I talked today that in the 70s, very popular book was Transistor. It's very simple. And everybody thought that each neuron, it's a transistor.
Yes.
Then it was each neuron, it's a microchip.
Yes.
Then each neuron, it's a microprocessor.
Yes.
Right now, people saying each synaptical connection, it's a microprocessor.
Yes.
Okay, so if it's a microprocessor, so you have a 10 in power 12 neurons. Each neurons have a 10 in power 5 synapses. So you have you can calculate how many parallel processing units you have in the brain if each synapse is a microprocessor, right?
Yes.
But as soon as you assume that each neuron is microprocessor, you assume that there is a programmer. Okay, so there is no programmers in the brain. There is no algorithms in the brain.
Well, don't we, through sensory input, generate a program? Say that somebody tells me to move my fingers. Don't I, in a sense, access part of the brain that controls the fingers, write a small algorithm that says, move the fingers, and then do that?
Okay, so there is a two. Well, first of all, you assume that there is a homunculus who make a decision in your head, right?
I've heard that term before. What does that mean?
Well, homunculus. When the pen filled, homunculus, from the medieval times, homunculus is artificially created human, small human being that all alchemists tried to, well, many of them tried to build the human in from the chemical elements. But in neuroscience, homunculus, it's a Penfield. When he mapped the brain, he mapped the human on the cortex of the brain. You saw the pictures.
Yes. So
the big hands, big mouth, you know, big feet, so that's a called homunculus. But in the same time, when you're talking about decision making, you have a sensory input. As a result, it have to be output. But somebody have to make decision, and
yes.
because there is no decision making neurons so far, so it have to be some homunculus inside, some small creature that make a decision.
Okay.
So from that point of view, that's your assumption that somebody have to make decision, right? So it's artificial, I think, that's artificial view on the brain and the processes in the brain. And because we have a computer era or eon, another one, so then you have to apply the idea that brain do programming, the brain do analysis, building algorithms. Okay, so it's your interpretation how the brain works.
Yes.
But because nobody saw the programs in the brain, nobody read the code. What's interesting, funny story. because you ask me, you have to know what to ask me about. So the at some point people say, well, right now, if you look around, about 5 labs in the world doing artificial retina, right?
Yes.
Okay. It's really fun because people ask me, what's artificial retina? Why you need a tank? We're just building artificial retina. It will be soon ready. No, wait a second. What do you mean artificial retina? So you create a matrix that you're going to connect to what? To optical nerve? Because if people lost the retina or retina not working, you have optical nerve, right? So somehow if you have ganglion cells that actually sending fibers to the brain intact, you have to implant the electrical stimulation on this layer, right? If this layer is intact.
Yes.
Otherwise, you have to connect to nerve. It's by itself impossible. Or implant something in the cortex that people did in the 70s, by the way. They did about 7 or 8 surgeries implanting microchip in the human visual cortex.
Oh, that's a big thing now in Sweden and stuff. But this is different. This is for brain sort of stimulation.
Okay, so you have, normally, you have about 1.5 million of fibers in the optical nerve, from 1 to 1.5. You have about 250 million of rods and about 50, 60 million of cones, color perception receptors.
Yes.
Matrix that people talking about artificial retina, it's a 16 by 16, working on 32 by 32. In the near future, 64 by 64. So you see, first of all, the size of the unit and the number of elements is not even close. The major problem is that cells that sending signal to the brain, it's outcome of the retina, output layer of the retina, it's only layer that sending impulses. Major part of the retina, it's analog device. Now, if you look in anatomy of the retina, you have many type of receptors. Then you have bipolar cells in between the layer of horizontal cells that integrate receptors. Then you have ganglion cells in between bipolar cells and ganglion cells. You have about from 14 to 40 types of amacrine cells. It's interneurons between second layer and third. Now, what we know that, you know, the vision work is an on system that receptors that reacting on increase of luminance and receptors that react on decrease of luminance. You have on system and off system. On and off system in the human retina have independent pathways inside of the retina. They not intersect. They have different cell types to conduct the signal. They have different neuromediators to transfer the signal, and only place that they coming together is visual cortex. Okay. Third fact, from the retina, signal going in 3 major pathways, not in 1, in 3. One is going typical visual cortex to give you idea about object position, shape, orientation, and so on. You have independent pathways going to movement analysis, everything that when you see moving targets and when you're moving yourself in the environment. And you have a third path that have a shortcut to your eye movement control. Okay? So if you calculate all components of the human visual system, you have about dozen independent visual systems. Another fact, you have 1 million fibers in the optical nerve. You can calculate frequency of discharge. It's about a couple hundred, 300, 400 spikes per second. You can calculate capacity of the nerve to transfer information. And if you calculate it in computer language, it's, 100 megabytes per second. But information that you're capable in the psychology experiment simultaneously analyze, it's a huge. So it's mean that by all means, I coding information.
Mm-hmm.
Inside of the retina, there is a coding routines, whatever, algorithms, that what you deliver to the brain, it's already zipped encoded and compressed information that's simultaneously going in the different areas of the brain. How you can emulate a retina if you don't know the language? We don't know the codes.
But you know the front end.
Yes.
And you can simulate the front end so that it matches whatever.
Okay, so you can recognize a door frame.
Yes.
On the black background. That's maximum what you can get from that.
Well, isn't this similar to like the cochlear implant? I think you have the same sort of phenomena going on there, don't you?
It's a little bit more simple than the visual thing.
Sure. Hearing is much more simple than vision, I would say in general. I have a friend, Dr. Michael Ignor, who is a neurosurgeon. He mentioned something to me which I found fascinating, and I'd like to get your take on this insofar as the homunculus. He said that when they operate on patients with open brains, that the neurosurgeon can actually go in and touch a part of the brain and make, for example, the fingers wiggle. And the patient, who is still conscious, says, "You made me do that." Then the next thing is that the physician will say, "Move your fingers the same way," and the person will move their fingers exactly the same way. It seems that the physiology in both cases is exactly the same, but the patient can distinguish between the imposed finger wiggling and his own conscious decision to make the fingers wiggle. Can the interpretation of this also include your idea that you've told me about of the homunculus?
No.
No? Do you have an idea what is happening there?
Well, I can answer brain is complex, but let's talk a little bit in more details. If we're talking about motor cortex in the human brain, usually frontal cortex is a decision-making thing. So your voluntarily movement start from there.
So there is something that actually lights up the part of the brain that moves the fingers in a way.
Yes, roughly, you switch in here.
Yes.
In the frontal lobe. So if switch send the signal, you move the finger.
Yes.
But in this place in the cortex, remember we talk about the columns? It's 10, 20,000 neurons that maybe more that initiate this movement. And it's five layers of different cells. Output from the cortex, it's usually layer 5 and layer 6.
Mm-hmm.
It's neurons that fire on the output. But you have 1,000 cells above them that can generate the signal.
I think what you're arguing generally is the physiological aspects are not identical.
If I touching the surface, mm-hmm. it's mean that I activating cells on the upper layers of the cortex. If we're talking about own decision, it's probably middle layers of the cortex. There is a difference where it's initiated. Outcome is the same, but the origin or trigger is a different.
Okay. So again, the physiology would not be exactly the same
exactly.
In both cases. Okay. Thank you. Dr. Daniloff, go ahead.
Wait a sec. So the you didn't ask me about the transcranial magnetic stimulation. That's even more popular.
Brain I didn't because I didn't know about transmedic stimulation.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, so it's a very popular toy. It's an interesting story. Because originally it was developed for diagnostic. You just remind me because it started from the same story.
I see.
So it's 8-shaped coils when they create extremely strong focused magnetic field. An idea was that the magnetic field can induce the current in the fibers or in the branches of the neurons because it's electrolyte. So, and people design really working systems, so you probably saw it. It's like figure eight shape and people just clicking. So they have an impulse that's very noisy that create this magnetic shock.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, they designed for diagnostics. So they shock your motor cortex, you move your fingers.
I see.
An idea was that if you measure latency, you can check the point to see where the problem is. It's a spinal cord, it's a peripheral nerve, or something like that. Okay? Pure technical approach. But by some reason, nobody knows historically how it's happened. But diagnostic device people decided to use for treatment. And right now, all around the globe, in every clinic, there is a bunch of devices and people just shocking other people's head, hoping to to get some results.
Sounds like a good hobby.
No, usually I explain it like that. So if you remember analog TV, do you remember?
I do, yeah. Okay. I'm an electrical engineer. Yeah,
if so. The pictures start to be fuzzy, what's your first action?
On a television?
Yeah.
I guess I would either change the antenna or I would tune it or crank up the power.
Okay, majority of people just hit the button. Okay?
Yeah, I would probably do that, but last.
Okay, so that's the idea of transcranial magnetic stimulation. To hit something, hoping that it will fix. So something will work what you need. That start the something that not working start to work.
Fascinating.
Okay? And it's indeed, it's one of the, if you look on the literature, it's about half of papers about brain stimulation. It's transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's a shock. But again, the question is how reproducible results are.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem to repeat, even on myself, to repeat the same experiment, it's have to be three-dimensional laser system, because to put the magnet in a specific angle in a specific spot,
you need three coordinates.
Even more, because my head might be positioned, also have to be positioned in a specific way. Okay, so it's really very difficult to reproduce the same results.
Well, thank you, Dr. Daniloff. This has been a fascinating discussion. Our guest today has been Dr. Yuri Daniloff. He is a former head of the Tactile Communication and Neuromodulation Laboratory at the Kinesiology Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This has been Mind Matters News. Until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.